Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And as far as the fiction side of things goes, as a quick update, I have the honor of being the guest editor of short fiction for Prime Number magazine. You can find out more information on that through their issue that just came out, issue 151. I'll be editing short fiction for the next issue, issue 163, and that's the one that runs from October through December of this year. So submissions to that, if you have some short fiction that you would like to put up for publication, I'll be happy to read it. Send me your best stuff. Submissions are open through June 30th, 2019. You can find links to submit through Press 53's Prime Number magazine. I also have links to it through my website on the news section. So, for this podcast, I want to talk about botanical monsters. And it looks like human hair! I'm just a mean way mother from the honest place. Get off my back! Get off my face! I'm mean and free! And I am bad! Don't you talk to me about old King Kong. You think he's the worst? Well, you're thinking wrong. Don't talk to me about Frankenstein. He got a temper? Ha! He ain't got mine! Alright, so for botanical monsters, I mean any type of plant-like monster. And no big surprise, like most of our other monsters on this show, what makes a plant monster? Normally, if they eat people. there's a surprisingly high number of plants that eat people in stories, in myth, maybe in real life. Let's hope not as common as they are in stories anyway. But not always the eating people. I think there's some really brilliant and excellent and serious types of botanical monsters we can get to, but I can't help it. I want to go to one that's one of my favorites of all time, and that's Little Shop of Horrors, Audrey 2. This gigantic, what eventually starts off as a tiny little Venus flytrap looking plant, and then Seymour Krelborn, this little loser guy, finds this mysterious plant that came from outer space, and then he finds out that if he feeds it blood, it grows and grows, and eventually helps out his loser life, or helps him become less of a loser. And so he keeps feeding this evil dark genie Faust with this kind of Faustian-like deal, and it grows and grows until it becomes gets out of his control, and it's this horrible man-eating monster of a plant that he names after the girl he loves, Audrey 2. The original one, the original film by Roger Corman's, and it was way back in the day, black and white film. That thing is hilarious. And I mean, it has these moments that you see, you don't really see as much of that humor until you get back around to, I don't know, maybe some of the really, some of the parody movies that started back up in the 80s, like Leslie Nielsen's Naked Gun kind of parody stuff. That kind of stuff is scattered throughout. And that one's hilarious. But I grew up on the 80s one with starring Rick Moranis. And if I'm remembering correctly, it was directed by Frank Oz, the puppeteer, and he does the voices, you know, all the voices like Yoda and what have you. And man, not only was that, did it turn this kind of wacky, over-the-top, strange type of horror movie into a musical and had some fantastic talent. Let's not forget this immense budget. It had like a $25 million budget, which was pretty hefty for this type of movie in the 80s. And the original Roger Corman one in 1960, it was like $30,000. So even if you adjust for inflation, the production value went way, way up. Roger Corman, of course, is used to turning lead into gold, you might say. He always turns a profit and he always makes really good films out of seemingly nothing. But the 80s musical Little Shop of Horrors, the most fascinating thing about it by far is the original ending. Now, if you haven't seen the original ending, it is absolutely worth every minute of the 12, 15 minutes that you will spend in your life watching this thing. And it was not necessarily an alternate ending. It was the ending to the film. And it will be no surprise to you to hear how the initial screening audiences reacted to it when I describe it to you. And so in this final battle with Seymour and Audrey too, Audrey, of course, has this hilarious musical number about how she's a mean green mother from outer space and she's bad. And with their little backup chorus, Venus Flytraps scares Seymour, beats him up, and then just totally swallows him whole and eats him. He's dead. That's it. And then Audrey just spits out his little glasses and then busts out. And then the chorus girls come in, you know, who have been through the whole movie in front of this giant American flag, like George, like the General Patton style, and start singing about how these kinds of things are happening all across America. And then you see like little TV sets in different apartments around America, people are watching like this special bulletin, like apocalypse. Of course, right before that, everybody in America is running to like A&Ps and grocery stores buying up these little plants. Well, the chorus girls are singing, like, and they attacked Cleveland, and they attacked Peoria, and they start naming all the cities that are being destroyed. And then it just goes for, like, 10, 12 minutes straight of New York City, in which these Godzilla-sized Audrey 2 flytraps, monsters laughing and eating and flinging their vines everywhere and destroying buildings, and not just one Godzilla size, like many, many of them, and they're just having a blast laughing, and while the chorus girls are singing about everybody's ultimate doom and how they ate the whole world, and people are screaming and running, and it goes on and on. They're smashing buildings. They're swallowing trains and laughing about it. It's a lot. They put a lot of money into this production. Like, it's they spared no expense on the details of the destruction of New York City. Like, a couple of the Godzilla-sized world-eating plants, like, go up to this factory with this smokestack and, like, breathe down into the straw and make all the, and, like, bag-feed all the smoke and blow it out. Like, they're coming up with all these hilarious ways to destroy the city, and they're just loving it. And the film finally ends, and, you know, everybody's dying and everything's being destroyed. And then it finally ends with these Audrey 2 plants climbing on top of the Statue of Liberty, and their tentacled vines are crawling down over her face, and the helicopters are swirling, and they're just laughing and laughing in this utter destruction of the world. The end. And that's it. And the whole world is eaten by these things. That was the ending of Little Shop of Horrors. And they screen tested it, and the feedback was extremely negative. So they decided to go back and then make some type of like, oh, and somehow he won and everything was fine, and that's all there was to it. And then they just like do a little wink at maybe it will continue again in that kind of horror cycle thing that we talked about in our last episode. But the second ending, the alternate one that we ended up with, all the way until recently, I think Warner Brothers kept the original ending on lockdown until, I don't know, the past 10 years or so, maybe even more recently than that. But you can find it on YouTube now, right, from somebody put it up there. I don't know. And so I would get, oh man, if I only had like 5 chances to time travel, I might waste one of them to take that video back to my young self who loved Little Shop of Horrors and this monster, Audrey 2, to show that little Josh Woods what the movie was really supposed to be. I think it would have changed my world. Like, it ends with Audrey eating the world. Okay. Oh my God, it's just so hilarious too. It's not horrifying in the way that you might expect. It's just hilarious. Anyway, I've done the best sales pitch I can possibly make to get you to, as soon as you have a chance around YouTube, watch this freaking thing. It's, if you haven't seen the original movie, maybe watch that first. But then watch this true ending to it. My God, it's great. Okay, so, let's get to, what are some other botanical plants we can name? I think these kind of, well, in film you see a lot of it, everything from the possessed vines and trees and Sam Raimi's Evil Dead, all the way back to, not too long after Roger Corman's Little Shop of Horrors, you had the Day of the Triffids, in which, once again, like, space alien plants land in America. This one, people go blind everywhere, and then these triffid, these like man-eating or at least murderous plants that are not the greatest special effects of that era. they just look like big, I don't know, like lawn and garden displays that were put together poorly and then put on wheels and they're just rolled around. The final scene in that film is where the hero is in this lighthouse, and then he just tries a last-ditch effort of spraying these triffids with seawater, just salt water, and it immediately dissolves them. And then he just kills all the plants, and then the narration comes in. I'm pretty sure it's trying to be kind of the H.G. Wells War of the Worlds, in which the unexpected simple solution is what kills off the aliens. But I don't know. That's not the first movie to make something like water harmful to invading aliens, and I just can never buy it that these aliens on an extremely hydrated planet are immediately killed by any amount of hydration. Does not, especially a plant. It just doesn't. Anyway. So, maybe I'm not as big of a fan of the Day of the Triffids, but that lighthouse showing up in a story about botanical monsters does show up elsewhere in Jeff Vandermeer's novel Annihilation. He has a whole, I think that's just the beginning of a whole series. He has a whole series. I only read the first novel of it called Annihilation. And I think the whole series is the Southern Reach series. Man, that's an excellent novel. It's really fast-paced, and it's wonderfully weird in that Lovecraftian way that it gives you these nightmarish visions, and it lets you in the middle of these visions so you can have this same kind of nightmare yourself, rather than just like stepping back and watching someone be weird and incoherent. It totally holds together as a story, and it moves so fast, and you're through the book in no time at all. It's excellent. But it is so strange. It's essentially, we have this team going into this mysterious like blocked off secret zone that has become overrun with wildlife, and it's a type of wildlife no one quite understands, and it's inching and spreading out, and the threat is that it's eventually going to spread over the whole world. And nobody really knows what goes on in there, and the teams that go in never come out, except for one circumstance. And that one just only made more questions than answers. And then you go in there, and they run into things like these plants overgrowing what was once this coastal area. I forget if it was originally a base or just a kind of a remote town. I'm kind of forgetting that part now, but the lighthouse is the center of the whole geography of the story. These plants are mimicking kind of blindly and incorrectly, but still capably mimicking the things that are touching and absorbing on planet Earth, in this buried silo, you have all these strange writings in which the plants and the vines and this mold is growing on its own to create these words in English, and they string together grammatically correctly, but they make no sense whatsoever. And as you like are reading along and you're collecting all these words of this thing that these aliens are writing out, and you eventually find that it makes no sense. It's these plants just mimicking what language sounds like, and it ends up being this big, long, crazy kind of feverish prophecy that says nothing, and it's fascinating. And then they'll find like other sections where plants are growing up just looking like the shapes of people, and in no time at all our protagonist like gets too close to the writing on the wall, and poof, this like puff of spore shoots out on her, and this is some type of strange alien plant and they're all in fear of their lives constantly in this kind of near suicide mission, and right away she poof, and she's hit with this stuff, and she keeps it a secret from everyone else. Now that's how you build up tension and subtext in a story. The every single scene in which she's talking with somebody else, it's ratcheted down with this amazing tension of, you know that she's already infected by something, and this is your main character, and she's not telling anybody. And, oh, so what other kinds of secret? It's just so cool, and it's done so well in this deep weird fiction tradition. And then I heard they were going to make a movie of the thing. Like, it's unfilmable. that was what I declared. And then I found out Alex Garland was not only taking on the project and directing it himself, but also adapting the screenplay. If you've listened to any of these podcasts, you've heard me, like, I don't know, fawn over the works of Alex Garland over and over and over. Everything from 28 Days Later to Dread to Ex Machina. I think just those three alone are just some of the best screenplays that have been written in, say, the past 20 years or so. And for me, at least, some of the most influential. And I thought, well, if anyone can do it, although I still think no one can, because it works great as fiction and not so much on film as Alex Garland. To Jeff Vandermeer's credit, I think the same thing of Lovecraft. I don't think we've seen anything close to a successful screen adaptation of anything Lovecraft ever wrote. I don't think it succeeds on the screen. I think the medium is just too different, and maybe I'll have to pinpoint exactly how and why. Anyway, ended up watching Annihilation, Alex Garland's. I love Alex Garland, man, but it just didn't work. I love that book. It just didn't work. There's like one moment, and that's worth watching in the whole thing. Oh, So, but I don't want to trash on, things too bad, because that book is excellent. I'm sure the other ones are awesome too, once I get my reading list cleared back to them. So anyway, there's at least a plug for Vandermeer's Annihilation, the novel. It's so awesome. And some of the coolest, most terrifying, weird plants that are sentient, it seems, and kill people. So other kinds of botanical monsters that stand out to me, what really got me going thinking I want to talk about botanical monsters was that, as you might already know, I'm still in the middle of teaching a literature class on the works of Tolkien, primarily Lord of the Rings, and we're deep into, well, now past, but deep into this section on Ents and the marching trees. Now, the end in Lord of the Rings, there's this forest called Fangorn, and nobody really knows much about it except that it's horrifying and dangerous. And what, long and short of it, is this forest and its guardian spirits, or its guardian monsters, are fed up with bad guys messing with them and cutting their trees down, and they're ready to go do some damage. And so, in the fights with the orcs and Saruman and the men of Dunling, the Ents end up shepherding a whole army of trees to the battle so that the escaping orcs end up getting lost in the forest, and we never know what quite happens to them, but it appears that they get eaten by trees. So what are Ents, and what are these trees that are marching around? Ents themselves, unlike what you might have seen in the Peter Jackson movies, they're not trees. They look like trees in the movie, but they're not. They're just giants, roughly 10 to 20 feet tall. I think the main Ent is Fangorn himself. The forest is his name, but he's also known by many names such as Treebeard. Ent, by the way, is one of the an Anglo-Saxon or an Old English word for giant, essentially cognate with, or the same word for Etin or Jotun or Jutun. And trolls and Ents in Tolkien's world are two of the same kind of species, just diverged for various reasons in the past. And they care about trees, and they consider themselves shepherds of trees. If you can be really just tree herd, but you know, they throw that word in there too. So they are tree herds, but you can't like make a tree move. Are they not really trees? Well, they are. The forest is mostly populated with real trees, and these Ents end up spending so many centuries and so many millennia around these trees that they themselves start looking and acting tree-like, for sure. But there's a different category of tree, not Ent and not normal tree, something in between called Huorns. And these are the ones that the Ents march down to eat the orcs and use to eventually march in and destroy the evil wizard Saruman's fortress of Orthanc in Isengard. These Huorns are mysterious trees. They are either Ents who have kind of turned into trees, or trees that have kind of grown sentience and mobility of their own. But we don't know much about them, except that apparently they're capable of eating people, like Audrey too, and moving around, like Audrey too. Although they're less Venus flytrap-like and more like giant trees. And I'm just now realizing that turning people into trees, that was one of the great features of another movie that freaked me out as a kid called Troll 2, in which these, they only call them goblins in the movie, so it makes you, by the end of it, wonder why it's called Troll 2. I think there was some sort of production marketing deal surrounding that. That was, I think that I think people kind of name that one has a cult following as well, like Little Shop of Horrors, although slightly differently. I think it's named as like one of the best worst movies of all time. And I think what makes these the bad stories and the bad films so lovable anyway is their absolute I hesitate to say sincerity. You can see that strange directors or writers put all their heart into it and they end up with something actually unique, surprising and unique, just not good is all. And that's a whole lot different than just trying, palely trying pastiche and then failing at it. And Troll 2 is, I think this kid moves, this family moves into this strange town, and then these goblins feed people this, like, green smoothie, and then it slowly turns them into plants, and so, and then they eat the plant. I'm pretty sure that's how the logic of it goes, if there is any logic to it at all. It's hilarious. Definitely worth if you're into watching late night bad movies, check out Troll 2, and then beware of drinking anything that looks green. I feel like I've wandered off track in several different ways now. And now I'm looking at the time. I'm thinking, okay, how about I ease back and go into maybe perhaps more like academic or at least closer look into the deeper meaning of these things. Why do we want to see, why do we have so many stories, many of them I haven't gotten to yet, so many stories of nature and these plants coming to life? So often it seems like the storyline behind their coming to life is a type of vengeance. I mean, vengeance as in like against humankind or industrialization and deforestation kind of thing. But also you can see in others vengeance or payback, I guess, retribution for other types of more modern sins, like mindless consumerism, I think is if you could point to any sin in Little Shop of Horrors that people have, this kind of greed and willingness to sell their soul for just getting a little bit better and a little bit more money kind of thing. But from the ends, I don't know, M. Night Shyamalan's The Happening, or even in Guillermo del Toro's Hellboy 2, there's a great scene in which this forest elemental or this nature god rises up out of the city and starts destroying the city again, and you can see it has this kind of vengeance quality about it. And then when it's finally killed, it has this great moment, kind of like in Miyazaki's Princess Mononoke, when the forest spirit dies and sheds its blood everywhere. It's essentially clovers and flowers, and it just has this really sad moment of like, yeah, nature is dangerous. Nature can kill you. If you're stuck in the wild and you're at the whims of nature. However, what does it mean to defeat nature? What it means to defeat nature is always kind of a little bit sad. Like you've just lost something that you'll never get back. And now you're in a safe world of like concrete and plastic. And it's not quite the same. At least it's always sad for me. But it's probably no surprise that I'm always a little bit rooting for the monster in any story or film. So what kind of functions do trees and forests and these botanical monsters have beyond that? I think part of what we see in a lot of these stories, especially let's say the dangerous forest, if those show that shows up in fairy tales and novels and in movies, and so often the function of the forest there is this dark place where you forget. You forget in that, like, whatever your mission is when you went into the dark forest, or whatever your goals are, or whoever your relationships are. Once you're in the dark forest, you are lulled into this deep forgetfulness, and very often it's associated with sleep, and so you'll be lulled to sleep. The characters in the fairy tale, they'll get lost, of course, so also being lost, but you get lost and then lulled into forgetfulness, or lulled into sleep, or all of them at once. And so this is, and I'm talking not of one specific one, but I mean, it could show up in everything from, you know, German fairy tales, Russian fairy tales, I mean, even in The Hobbit and in Mirkwood, all over the place. And it's, I guess, not so much an archetype. We might just say like motif, maybe is a better term for it. So this motif of the dark forest, this place where you forget who you are and why you came there. And so it's this deep return into this unconscious state of nature, I would say, in that you're kind of rewinding yourself back through time into your more animalistic or infantile self, in which you're not clearly aware of what it is you are, that you even are, or what you came to do. And so you're slumbering like an infant, or you are kind of now mindless like the animals that are or were in the past. And so the forest as this kind of motif for deep unconscious. And then the kinds of horrible things that are hidden in the forest are the perhaps the some of the, you know, most fitting images of the things that lurk in the unconscious mind, whether that's the witch of the wood in the hut who changes shape and comes out and gives dreamlike prophecy to you, or even in the dark forest, you get a lot of, especially in more fairy tale like stories, you get moments in which the trees themselves are portals to another world, in an almost dreamlike kind of way. So you might, everything from, say, Netflix's Stranger Things, in which getting into the hollow of a tree allowed at least one of the characters to cross over into the upside down. And that's where Will was lost, is in the dark forest. And then that's where you cross over into the other realm in the dark forest. But I mean, you also see trees as portals, and say, let's see, Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow. That was the portal to hell, or Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. How about that? That's the portal to Christmas land and all the other holiday lands. All right. And so there's something about the forest and the trees, and this being like this gateway to unconscious and to dream, for good or for ill. It depends, I suppose, on the story or maybe the person going into these trees. So that's perhaps a little broader look at the kinds of things like these dangerous forests or dangerous plants can do. I think maybe, oh man, there's so much I haven't mentioned. Old Man Willow, by the way, in Lord of the Rings, was one of these trees very early on in the story that attacks that makes the hobbits fall asleep and then swallows two of them. They can barely, if it weren't for Tom Bombadil coming along to save them, very early on in the story, two hobbits would have been eaten by a willow tree. That's pretty horrifying. Of trees that eat other things. There was a moment, I don't even know where it was, in Mung G.K. Chesterton's writings. I only know about it because Borges talked about it. He said G.K. Chesterton wrote of the tree on which birds perch And then the tree eats the birds that perch on it, and instead of leaves grows feathers. Now that's a nightmarish vision, if ever there is one. Much more nightmarish than Andre 2 just destroying New York City in absolute glee. That's a different kind of vision, and one that's I very much love, and I can't quite get over it. You can probably tell that I watched it right before this podcast, because I'm so pumped about that. But a truly poetic nightmarish vision, much closer, I would say, to G.K. Chesterton's. What if you're listening to this podcast and you're wondering, yeah, but what about like real life events or things that supposedly happen for real? I remember hearing from what I guess I won't drop names in case people want to remain anonymous, but I've heard of folklore of anytime you see a crooked or malformed tree, that's where an old crime took place, or something really bad happened to somebody right at that spot, and then up sprouted a twisted and crooked tree. So that's something to think about as you hike through the woods and notice some malformed ones. Stay away from that spot, perhaps. I'll tell you a weird one, though. Years and years and years ago, on the show Mythbusters, they were reluctantly testing some myths that they considered paranormal. And I think right after that show, they just like finally declared to the channel and the producers that they refused to do any more of that stuff because they had no patience for anything paranormal, of course. And they sent Tori, Grant, and Carrie off to test plant sentient myths. One of them was that if you hook a plant up to a polygraph and you're really mean to it, that it will produce readings of stress as like a human being or a sentient animal would. And hey, of course, they're cracking up when they're even talking about the notion. And so they go ahead and get a real polygraph and they hook it up right and they test it out on each other and they test it out on inanimate objects and do the control. And then they hook it up to the plant and they start screaming at the plant, telling the plant they're going to burn it and cut it down and everything. And they get readings and they get actual spikes in stress from the plant. And then they react. I can't recall if they have moments of surprise or not, but they react as like, okay, well, we must have done it wrong, right? Maybe the plant is reacting to our or the readings are actually off of the disturbance that we're making, like in the air and our body temperature and all that kind of stuff. And so the myth also goes that if you just think bad things toward a plant, the plant can pick up on it psychically and then stress, and that stress reading shows up on the polygraph. And so they do that. So Tori just stares at the plant and just thinks and visions of tearing its leaves off and burning it and doing as torturous a thing to this plant as he could possibly imagine. And in the other room where they're getting the polygraph readouts, sure enough, they start getting stress readouts of it. And so the plant was stressing out about this. And then they think, well, of course it can't be possible despite the evidence that we get because we already believe it's not possible. So let's try to control it to make sure that the polygraph isn't reading Tori instead of the plant. And so they remove him from the room and they have him stare at the plant through a glass, a window, and then think all the bad things. And then that's when they get no reading from the plant whatsoever. And they're like, see, busted. It was nonsense all along. But hold up. If the plant is safely locked away from the psycho who wants to burn it in the other room, and then what reason would the plant have to be stressed? So isn't that like J.M. Coetzee's Elizabeth Costello wondering about these intelligent tests that they put these animals through, like the chimpanzee they set out a banana and he eats it every day, and then the tester comes up and puts the banana high on this hook out of his reach and puts a chair on the other side of the room. And they're like, the chimp can't figure it out. How do you know the chimp's not like, how do you know the chimp doesn't just have hurt feelings? How do you know the chimp isn't like, why would he do this to me? Does he wish I were taller? Why would they want to take my bananas away? Does he wish to humiliate me? Maybe they're too smart for the test. Maybe you're not thinking all the way through. Maybe the plants do react, and maybe given the opportunity, they would grow to gigantic Godzilla size, rise up, multiply in the millions around the United States and presumably the world, and then spend a long, glorious rampage of a day destroying all the cities and eating the world, just like we began this podcast. Others we didn't talk about. We could talk about Yggdrasil. Oh, man. Can't talk about Yggdrasil. There's so many other things we could talk about, but we are at about the 40-minute mark. Let's call it good for a Botanical Monsters podcast today. So I hope you found something enjoyable or useful out of this podcast. If you made it this far, if nothing else, you survived another episode. So thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time on The Monster Professor.